This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL, Urbana. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. How do nations live in the wake of calamity? How do they reinvent themselves? Erna Parks delves into these questions in her new book, Long Shadows, Truth, Lies, and History. Paris opens the book by quoting from George Orwell's 1984. He who controls the present controls the past. He who controls the past controls the future. Paris looks at the Holocaust, the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, apartheid in South Africa, slavery in the U.S., and genocide and extreme nationalism in the former Yugoslavia. Journalist Erna Paris is our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for our guest, Erna Paris. Join the discussion with a telephone call. The number in Champaign-Urbana is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 1-800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Erna Paris is the author of six books, including The End of Days, Tolerance, Tyranny, and the Expulsion of the Jews from Spain. Her work has won many awards. Her new book, Long Shadows, has just won a major nonfiction award in Canada, the Pearson Writers' Trust, for a work of the highest literary merit. Long Shadows, Truth, Lies, and History is published by Bloomsbury. Again, questions and comments are welcome in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Anywhere else, toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. Erna Paris, good afternoon. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Celeste.
What led you to take on this project?
Well, I think it's I've been thinking about the subject of how countries come to terms with their past, especially after times of crisis, for a very long time. When I was a young student living in France in the early 1960s, I just happened literally to stumble upon what turned out to be the only death camp the Nazis had ever established in France, within the Vosges Mountains. In those days, no one talked about such things, and I visited. There was a guide, although my friends and I were the only people there. And the shock remained with me for a very long time, and basically I began to wonder about how countries, especially in this case France, remembered its wartime history, because I was hearing a great deal about the resistance fighters in France, but nothing about the deportation of the Jews.
Mm-hmm. I did not know that there was a Nazi death camp in France. I was completely unaware until I was reading your book.
Well, it is not very well known. In fact, most of the histories of the Holocaust do not mention it. The only book I've ever come across actually giving the history of this camp was written in French in France by a historian there.
Hmm. Well, tell us just a little bit about the history of this place.
Well, it was apparently put in place primarily for two reasons. One, as a death camp where people were brought in, some of them from Germany itself, from other camps. They were put to death, gassed, and then horrifically, actually, their bodies were sent to a scientist who worked, a German, a Nazi scientist who worked in Strasbourg, and experiments were done on dead bodies and autopsies and so on. This is the story that was told by this French historian I mentioned, and it's horrific. The other reason for the camp, I learned, was that French resistance fighters were sent there. It was, in that sense, a work camp. And when I went there, the camp was being memorialized, so to speak, a little bit, because there was a guide there, but as a camp for the for resistance fighters.
Hmm. How did France's history of its myth of being a place of resistance begin to take shape?
Well, it really took shape immediately at the end of the war. Now, there was an important French resistance. It just just wasn't as large as it has been made out to be. The reason that the myth evolved was that when General de Gaulle, who'd been in London with the Free French, with the resistance, returned to France, it was really important to establish the country once again as a republican country. France, as people will know, was occupied in part by the Nazis. The other part was led by Marshal Philippe Pétain, who had been a famous general of the First World War. And it was located in the town of Vichy, of water fame, of course. And Vichy France collaborated very openly and explicitly with the Germans and, in fact, delivered French Jews to the Nazis for deportation before they were asked to do so. It's quite extraordinary. So when de Gaulle came back, the important political thing was to reestablish the country as a republic. And the way that that was done was to claim that everyone, or almost everyone, had been in the resistance. They conducted trials. They were really purges because they were mostly extrajudicial and people were executed. The trials were of the most visible collaborators, the kinds of people who had marched around with the Nazis in jackboots and so on. And once those trials were completed, it was easy for people to say, okay, well, we finished with that. Let's get on with the future. This is something that governments love to say after times of crisis, let's forget the past and get on with the future. And people were very happy to do that because there were hundreds of thousands of people who did not want their own acts to come to the light of day. And in fact, they didn't until France started conducting its trials in the 1980s, starting with Klaus Barbie.
Hmm. We have a listener already waiting to talk with us, so let's talk with this caller who is joining us from Richland County this afternoon. Good afternoon.
Yes, I watched something on the History Channel a month or so back, and it showed the French police rounding up the Jews. They set up a roadblock and grabbed these, checked all the papers, and grabbed about four or five Jews out of there, and but it was the French police doing this work. And it's really odd because the other night I was driving through a town, through Olney, and I saw the state police set up a roadblock. And if you'd changed the emblems on the squad cars, I thought I was in 1942 France. But am I correct? Didn't the French police round up most of the Jews for the Germans?
Yes, they did. In fact, the Germans didn't have to do very much. There were only approximately 2,500 German officers in France during the occupation, and the work was definitely done by the French police. And you know, it is this It is the fact that the French were involved that made this story resonate and remain in the minds of the victims. The story that the French were involved were all resistance fighters has been taught to French school children for two or three generations now. And it is, as I say, beginning to break down. But the victims and their children and their grandchildren, of course, never forgot. There was just never the possibility of having their story known. The man who essentially was responsible for bringing Maurice Papon to trial was a French Jew from Bordeaux, where Papon, who was a civil servant in charge of Jewish affairs, operated. This man's entire family was arrested by the French police in 1942. He escaped, and when he came back, he began to pick up ideas that in fact it had been done by the French. And he spent decades of his life just tracing this story and hunting it down. And eventually, Maurice Papon was brought to trial in France in 1997.
Mm. So one person can do so much. It's rather incredible to think about, isn't it?
It is. Yes, it is. And the reason that I think one person or victims in general can eventually bring their stories to bear is because they care so much about it. They care much more in the long term than the descendants of government people, for instance, or those who wish to suppress the story care. This, we're still talking about France, is essentially what happened in that country. The children and the grandchildren of people who had been deported eventually were able to tell their story because those who had been involved, that generation, was dying off. And the French population in general was much more receptive to hearing the truth.
I want to talk now about Yugoslavia. This is a really powerful chapter in the book. And at the outset of this chapter, you quote a politician who says, who's also a literary lion there, "Lying is a form of our patriotism and is evidence of our innate intelligence. We lie in a creative, imaginative, and inventive way." Who do you quote?
His name is Dobrice Čosić, and he is one of the most famous writers in ex-Yugoslavia. He is a Serb. He is also the person who was pointed out to me by people throughout the former Yugoslavia as being perhaps the central individual responsible for creating the new nationalism after the death of Tito, when there was, shall we say, an ideological void, and for presenting this nationalism as a way of governing to Slobodan Milosevic, who it is widely believed was primarily an opportunist interested in power, and this was a way of achieving it. But the whole question of lying, of governments lying in order to influence the way the past is perceived and the way the present operates, is particularly interesting, I think, in the ex-communist states. And I was particularly taken by the comment of a former dissident in Yugoslavia who once said the hardest thing about being a communist is learning how to predict the past. Anything concerning truth in history is really a joke when it comes to countries that see their past as a means of controlling the present and the future, as Serbia, for example, did when it used an event, a battle from the late 14th century, to shape nationalism and to foment the possibility of war in the Balkans in the 1990s.
Hmm. You met him and interviewed him, Čosić. What is he like?
Well, he's a man in his 70s. I got the interview through an acquaintance who, and I was told that we weren't supposed to talk politics.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, that's fine. And when I got to meet Čosić, of course, what he wanted to talk about was politics. And so did I. He was wary, but he lied to me too. He said very clearly that the war for Greater Serbia was a movement that would create multiculturalism. Well, his own statements over 15 years, and of course those of Milosevic and all the people in power in the push for Greater Serbia, were not talking about a multi-ethnic or multicultural state in which there would be equality for all. And I must say that during our conversation, where he reminded me that even Jesus Christ had been misunderstood, I thought about the quote that you mentioned, lying as a form of our patriotism, and thought this is the only way I can understand what is going on here.
Is such an open acknowledgement of lying unusual? I mean, here you have this man, you quote him saying, "Lying is a form of our patriotism. We lie in a creative, imaginative, and inventive way."
Well, I think it probably is. I think it's certainly most leaders who do lie about the past don't necessarily broadcast it as a virtue, I'd have to say. Japan, for example, which has officially denied its war crimes in China in the 1930s during the Pacific War, doesn't say openly that what it is teaching its children is a lie. It just simply leaves out various aspects of its country's history.
Mm. One of the myths of the Serbian nationalists, there has never been anti-Semitism in Serbia. Tell us how that myth was propagated.
Well, that myth goes back to the Second World War and the partisans under Tito who were fighting the Nazis. So the myth evolved that, in fact, since they were fighting the Nazis and the Nazis were anti-Semites and trying to capture Jews, that the Serbs were not anti-Semites. In fact, there was a very strong fascist movement in Serbia at the time of the war, and as in Croatia, as is known, and one of the things that was done was that the Jews were actually delivered to the Nazis because there was a quota that a certain numbers of partisans had to be delivered, or Serbs had to be delivered, and it was easier to deliver the Jews.
Mm. You met people, though, who in the former Yugoslavia, who are painfully aware of their country's history.
Yes. I was there in 1997, in late 1997. As we all know, Milosevic has now been arrested, and there is a new regime in Serbia. We don't quite know what it's going to do with regard to the past yet. It's, I think, going to be very interesting to see how they handle the crimes that were committed. But the members of the then opposition, the people that I met, were, I think, the most bitter, cynical, and despairing of people that I met anywhere in my travels. And I traveled four continents to write this book. There was a sense that there was no possibility of ever uncovering the past, of ever finding justice.
Mm. And what do you think about that perception, that point of view? Do you think they may be right? Do you think they are wrong?
Well, I think that they are, that these people are extremely happy today that there has been a change of regime. Hmm. And that essentially it happened with so little violence. Whether there will be justice for Milosevic and his cronies remains an open question. The Serb government today is developing legislation which may enable it to send Milosevic to the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia in The Hague. On the other hand, they may choose to try Milosevic in Belgrade, and they may not even try him for war crimes. You know, it's very, very difficult when you think of the collusion, if you wish, of large parts of a population in war crimes. People may not actually be enacting crimes themselves, but they may be passive. Not just observers, but they may accept this and promote this passively. And so there's, after these events, there is often a sense of collective responsibility, collective discomfort in the population. And this is the case today in Serbia. I know that among Serb intellectuals, there is a beginning discussion about this collusion, about responsibility and guilt. But so far, it is, needless to say, not the favorite subject of ordinary people.
Hmm. Let's talk with another listener, this one on the toll-free line in Taylorville. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I am preoccupied with the way the media in this country handle such issues as you're talking about. For example, I know this sounds trivial, but the Toon Channel recently did a comprehensive, well, it wasn't that comprehensive because they edited out anything that might have been construed by the most genteel body as racist, and they completely did away with about a dozen of the cartoons. And I really think that I'm reminded of Santayana's most famous observation, those who can't, those, Jesus, all of a sudden,
those who forget the past are condemned.
Condemned, yeah, right, mm. Right. Now, I think there's a kind of adolescent lust to, in this country, and I dare say it's true in other peoples, for example, the French and the Japanese, to forget the horrors of their, to disremember, to borrow a word, I think, Pogo or somebody like that used on occasion, the horrors of their own past, and it's certainly alive and kicking in this country. And this what I call adolescence, manifests itself very strongly in our politics. For example, you've got millions of people who, when a certain entity, I call it the great boobaloonium, hangs out in the White House mainly, calls itself a compassionate conservative, are ferociously willing to believe that that it is. People who want to believe lies and who do not want to believe the truth, I don't think are worthy of calling themselves democratic human beings. In fact, I marvel that I'm somewhat distantly related to that mass.
Well, as a matter of fact, in Long Shadows, one of the themes that I have approached in Long Shadows is the whole question of the fault line of race in the 20th century, which I think is central to our understanding of the 20th century through the legacy of slavery producing racism in the United States, to apartheid in South Africa, to questions of colonialism throughout the world. And here in the United States, the question I ask myself as a Canadian, my entire focus in this book is that of the outsider looking in, I should say, is why is it that this great democracy of the United States has not been able to lay that past to rest? Why is it that racism has remained endemic? I traveled around the south of the United States. I interviewed as many people as I could, both African American and white Americans, who are interested in the subject. And one of the things that seemed to emerge was that there has never been any kind of official acknowledgement in this country of what was done to a portion of the population. Some people argue that the 13th and 14th Amendments represent some sort of apology. Some people point to what Lincoln said and so on. But from the point of view of the government of the state itself, there is not a monument on the Washington Mall, which is the heart of this country's history, and there has never been an official recognition or statement of apology.
Mm-hmm.
Now, some people say, well, that was a long time ago, and I wasn't here, my ancestors were immigrants, and so on and so forth. This has nothing to do with me. I think the point is that when a government or state has condoned abuses of of a very serious sort, such as slavery, the recognition of that, the apology, or whatever, the memorials, whatever it is one does, has to come from the state. It is the state that makes amends, not individuals. And I think that's an extremely important point.
You mentioned in that chapter at the outset that this country has made many other official apologies to Japanese Americans who were interned during World War II, to people affected by nuclear tests, to Native Hawaiians, to survivors of government-sponsored syphilis experiments. So from where you sit, why do you think the initiative to apologize for slavery has been so controversial and has ultimately failed, or ultimately failed? Well, I don't know, I suppose we might revisit it at some point in this country, but so far failed.
Well, I think that it's a very complex question, and I can only think that in terms of my comparative look around the world, that perhaps I can offer one suggestion. It seems to me that the other apologies that that you've just mentioned did not touch the heart of the American enterprise, which is the Declaration of Independence and the creed of equality for all. The issue of slavery does touch that heart, particularly since the Declaration of Independence was created while there was chattel slavery happening. So clearly not all people living in this country were considered to be affected by the declaration. It is possible that even after emancipation, even after the civil rights movement, that African Americans have never fully been included in the American dream as it was defined in that seminal document. And because this is somehow, this touches so closely to the heart of American beliefs, it is extremely difficult to deal with. That is a theory only.
A majority of white Americans opposed the apology, but there was also opposition on the part of African Americans, including Jesse Jackson. And you also include the columnist Thomas Sowell, and I'm going to open the book to that page and read what he wrote at the time, and then I want to ask you about that. He wrote, let's see, "The idea of inherited racial guilt, a Nazi conception behind the proposed apology, would do nothing to heal the racial divisions in this country today. It would only promote further polarization. What would this apology do for blacks is looking backward, a way to prepare for the future."
Mm-hmm. Well, I think I was saying before that many people, and I think it's a particularly American perspective, wish to look to the future. And Canada is the same. We are not societies that tend to look towards the past to solve our problems. We are new societies, both of us. Of course, there are many African Americans who don't believe that that an apology or looking into the past would be of any use, just as there are many whites who think that. There's no such thing as groupthink or collective thinking. I would disagree with Thomas Sowell when he suggests that looking back is not a way to help reconcile what has happened. In my experience for researching and writing this book, I think, in fact, it is the only way that until nations are willing to face the truth about their past in a compassionate way, not in a hostile way, that these things simply go on and on and on. I'll give you an example of something that's just happened in Chile. The new president has said that he is going to establish a museum or a library, I forget which, and he is going to collect the writings of Chilean expatriates, people who were forced to flee the country during the Pinochet regime. He's going to collect these writings and use them as part of the history of his country. In other words, he does not intend to exclude the history of Chile, even this horrible part, and pretend that it didn't happen or try to whitewash it or to say that somehow it was an anomaly. He is saying, this is a part of who we are. This happened to us here, and we are going to acknowledge it, accept it, and teach it to our children. I think that's the only way.
You traveled through the South for this book. You traveled through the state of Mississippi in the late 90s doing research for the book. What do you remember most vividly about your trip through Mississippi?
Well, I guess it was my trip to the Mississippi Delta. I went to a tiny town on the Delta, where there was an election rally taking place. And I went because I was very interested to see what the whole process of voting and electioneering was in late 1990. This was 1998 or 1999, so many years after African Americans got the vote, and in a community, a very depressed community of the United States. In fact, the mayor of this community, a woman called Eunice Blackwell, was the first woman elected as mayor of her community in, I think it was in Mississippi, in the whole of Mississippi. Mm. I guess I was surprised by two things there. One, that Eunice Blackwell, that her concern was not primarily the economic development of her small town, but actually developing self-esteem and the teaching of Black history. And when I questioned this, it was suggested to me that this was a white prejudice on my part. Maybe it was. That came as a surprise to me. The other thing was talking to the man who was running the campaign of the candidate who was speaking there that day, a man who had dedicated his life to trying to push African Americans to vote, to use their vote, and a man who was greatly disappointed that more people were not using the vote. So I guess those two events in that very small place were greatly surprising to me.
Mm-hmm. What were your thoughts about the mayor in Mayersville, her mission to for a greater awareness of African-American history, for Afrocentric history?
Well, I certainly understand that this is an issue for many people and that it is important. On the other hand, I thought that given the extreme poverty of this community, that she might have other priorities. Mm-hmm. So I know that the whole question of African American history has become an issue for many African Americans who feel that their story has not been told. I think this is extremely important. But by contrast, I also interviewed the man who is head of archives in Charleston at the the Avery Institute, an extraordinary man, Sherman Pyatt. Middle class, highly educated man. And what surprised me in talking to him and interested me was that his fears for his children, for instance, were the same fears that had been expressed to me by the poorest of the poor, African Americans, a fear of violence and a fear of racial profiling, I think you call it.
Also in Charleston, South Carolina, you met a very interesting woman who you just identify in the book as Sandra. And I thought her, what she had to tell you was also very interesting. Is that she clearly felt the ghosts of Charleston and the ghosts of slavery, and that Charleston is a place still living very much in the past.
Yes, she did. I actually felt very lucky to have gained the trust of people like Sandra and others like her, and this is all over the world, who spoke to me with great candor. Sandra had been working in Los Angeles for HBO, actually, and really at the cutting edge of movies and in broadcasting. And she had returned to Charleston to look after an aging mother. And somehow being back in this environment was affecting her very deeply. And she claimed that she could hear the moans of slave ancestors. I remember clearly when she told me this, she kind of looked at me strangely, well, kind of with some curiosity to perhaps gauge my level of skepticism. But she did continue. And what came out through the conversation was her feeling that Charleston was a very quiet city in terms of, I mean, that there was no violence to speak of in Charleston and so on, but that, as she said it, said people knew their place. She said that blacks knew their place in Charleston, and whites knew that blacks knew their place, and in that sense she felt that it was a city very much living in the past. She talked to me about the fact that although she had a graduate degree, she was only able to get a low-level job in the city. The other thing, of course, I remember about that town is taking a tourist bus through the city, which is something I often did when I was visiting places. I'd just become an ordinary tourist just to see how the city was presented to tourists. And I got on this bus, and we went by the old slave market. I knew what it was from my reading, et cetera. But the guide didn't mention it at all, except to say that we could possibly get some souvenirs and trinkets there. But there was no mention at all about the history of Charleston. And this brings me back to what I was saying before. I think that if history, whether it's good or bad, is acknowledged, is brought into the sphere of the narrative of a country, a city, or what has happened in a place, it is much, the process of reconciliation will be engaged much more easily.
Mm. Let's talk with another listener, this one on line one in Champaign. Good afternoon.
Hi, good afternoon. Yeah, it strikes me that much of what you had to say today could apply right here to University of Illinois and the issue of Chief Illini Weck. You may not be familiar that the university sports teams uses an Indian mascot, this mythical Chief Illini Weck, who, interestingly enough, not only does a Caucasian student play the role, but the ceremonial clothing, it actually belongs to the Sioux, Plains Indian, not a Woodland Indian. That has nothing to do with the Illini, and does this so-called dance, which involves flying splits and a lot of hopping around and stuff, that also bears no resemblance to traditional Indian dances. And then when Native Americans complain about this, the defenders of Chief Illini Weck, you know, will come up with all sorts of things like, we weren't responsible for, the demise of these people, and we're really honoring them using this, symbol and doing all this stuff, and you know, even we'll say, well, you know, the Illini were killed off by other Native Americans, and then not even considering the fact that perhaps part of what was, you know, driving them out of Illinois was the pressure on other Native Americans from the east being pushed to the west and things like that. But I'm just curious to see what you had to say about that.
Well, I think what you're describing is essentially what I've been saying, that it's so easy, isn't it, to say, well, other people did this. It had nothing to do with me. If this happened in the country in which we were born or to which we immigrated and to which we owe our allegiance, then we, in a sense, become responsible for what our country did, whether we were here or not, and for trying to, at the very least, respect those who were abused at one time. And it seems to me that if the Native group themselves are unhappy with this depiction, that is reason enough at the very least to reconsider such an event.
I want to thank the listener for his call this afternoon, and we're growing short on time. We've got another person waiting to talk with us on line 4 in Eureka. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. This will be very short. You made the remark that if there were only 2,500 officers, German officers in France to rule the country which they occupied. It seems to me, from what I've read, the French citizens were almost as bad as the Germans in terms of their attitudes and bringing different Jews into the horrible system the Germans had. Would you care to comment on that?
Well, at the beginning, this is true. There was collaboration and so on and so forth. There's no question about that. But starting when the French became aware of the roundups that were taking place, a change did take place, a very important change, starting with the Catholic Church itself. That and this did influence the attitudes of the French, who then began to block the deportations of the Jews. So I think that, in fairness to the French, it's worthwhile pointing out that fewer Jews were eventually deported from France, given their numbers, than from any other occupied country. And this is because the French population began to resist this.
I want to thank that listener for his call this afternoon. Before we go, I wanted to ask you about your thoughts on reconciliation through international justice. This seems to be the direction that we're headed in here at the beginning of the 21st century. Thoughts?
I think that at the end of the 20th century, which may go down on record as one of the worst, or perhaps the worst, that we've lived through, perhaps the most optimistic sign is this return of international human rights law, the return of Nuremberg, if you wish, where the crime first, where the notion of a crime against humanity was born and legislated, and then subsequently just lay in the shadows during the whole of the Cold War and has been revived since 1989. At the moment in The Hague and in Tanzania, where the crimes of Rwanda are being tried, we see international justice taking place, and we also see moves to establish a permanent international criminal court, which would try people on for the worst crimes, such as crimes against humanity and genocide, when the countries in question either refuse to do so or do not have the infrastructure to do so. This, I think, is a tremendously important development at the beginning of the 21st century, and one which will at the very least give pause to future tyrants, and there are sure to be future tyrants.
Yeah. I wonder also if it, and just a brief comment on this, if you will, because we're out of time, but I wonder also if for the better we might start to rethink our ideas of nationalism.
Well, there's nothing wrong with nationalism as long as it's not the kind that excludes others and promotes promotes war. I mean, what we call patriotism is the way that we establish our commitment to our country. But there are lines that mm-hmm. cannot and should not be crossed. Mm.
Thank you very much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Erna Paris has been our guest this afternoon. Look for her book, Long Shadows, Truth, Lies, and History. It is published by Bloomsbury.